Father James Bornauer is professor of philosophy and director of the Center for Christian Jewish Learning here at Boston College, where he joined the faculty in 1980. His research centers upon the work of Michel Foucault and Hannah Arendt, and on philosophical and theological questions surrounding fascism and the Holocaust. He's the author or editor of several books on Arendt and Foucault, and has published numerous philosophical articles on an array of subjects. He holds 4 graduate degrees, a PhD in philosophy, an STM in psychiatry and religion, an MDiv in theology, and an MA in philosophy. And today he'll be speaking about how the religious character of Boston College enhances the school's experience as a community of learning. His title is The Faiths of a Catholic University, Personal or Impersonal. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for coming this afternoon. What such a beautiful day. Let me just say at the beginning, this was an effort on my part to get clear for myself about where we are. And it isn't necessarily connected to the seminar, although I learned a lot from the seminar discussions that we have, this Catholic Intellectual Tradition seminar. So what I was looking for was a framework in terms of which to conceptualize Boston College's current situation as a university that has a religious heritage and has a religious aspiration. The title basically states my thesis, or the faiths of Boston College as a Catholic university, personal and impersonal. First, there are plurality of religious faiths represented at BC, as well as humanistic faiths. And that condition will increase most likely in the years ahead. And there's also a series of levels of faith among any particular person who's here. Secondly, one way of conceiving its Catholic identity is the aspiration to inclusiveness and to a harmony of faith and knowledge. That Catholicism does represent an aspiration to universality. And certainly the tradition is that faith and knowledge are not enemies of one another. Thirdly, the key dividing line in terms of relevance for us is operating today is not between the secular and the religious, between faith and knowledge, authority and academic freedom, but rather that between the personal and the impersonal. Now that's a strong claim on my part. And finally, John McMurray's philosophy of religion offers one helpful template for understanding religion as the realm of the personal. Not that all religions necessarily embrace this realm of the personal as their own identity, but understand religion as the realm of the personal and as the integration of the two great forms of intellectual pursuit. On one hand, the arts concerned with the ends of life, and the scientific concerned with the world as means. That's a sort of basic structure. Now, John McMurray, he was born in Scotland, and his books are still in print, or several of them are still in print. But I think he's a neglected philosopher. I think he offers a great deal. But he came along at a time when English philosophy became terribly concerned, obsessed almost, with methodology and language. And John McMurray's vision was much broader. He came back to some prominence recently because Tony Blair attributed his perception of government. He said it was indebted to John McMurray. And actually, there's a new collection of essays that's of McMurray's work that has an introduction by Tony Blair. But now, one of the lines I love of John McMurray, and it's a sort of slogan of his philosophy, is that all meaningful knowledge is for the sake of action, and all meaningful action is for the sake of friendship. So he has a very communal sense of the human project. Now, in terms of my own personal coming to this formulation, this framework, I just thought I'd give some of the areas that have influenced the way I approach it. First is the Catholic Intellectual Tradition Seminar. That one of the things that was not surprising for me is this terrific satisfaction that people have in being at Boston College. And that doesn't depend upon their religious identity. I mean, it's different religious identities feel very comfortable at Boston College. And it surprised me to some extent that people felt this long time ago. They felt, I would have thought that when Boston College was more Jesuit, obviously much more Catholic, it would have been more difficult for non-Catholics to feel welcome here. that doesn't seem to be the case in terms of this. I can't say it's a representative group, but that was very strong. And what the real point that was made on that is they felt personally welcome, that there was a personal sensibility at Boston College. And there's some sense, perhaps, that we have to safeguard that, however we describe it. And I found myself being reminded of an incident, a lecture that a trustee gave a number of years ago, in which he talked about, it was to a group of Jesuits, and he mentioned that when he was in his, I think, first year, his mother died, and he was at the funeral, and he saw all these BC people at the Mass, the funeral Mass. And he said, I realized I was in something more than a school. And it's that more that I'm trying to do justice to. At that time, of course, it was appearing out of the liturgical. But that was symbolic of a deeper relationship, it seems to me, that individuals in the school had with students. And that somehow our lives were connected on a more profound level than what takes place just in the classroom. Another source for my approach is Holocaust studies, which I've been concentrating on in recent years. And if you do Holocaust studies or study fascism, it's quite clear that reality doesn't recognize this border between religion and the secular. Fascism is one of the prime examples of how the interpenetration of the secular and the religious is what's motivating people, leading people on. And I refer there to a book by Friedlander, Saul Friedlander. Everyone was waiting for this book. He's the most distinguished historian of the Holocaust. Is the second volume of his magisterial work came out in 2007. And he makes that statement at the very end of his book, that there's only one plausible interpretation of what happened in the Holocaust. And he goes on to say that there's this need for some sort of presence of religious or pseudo-religious incentives within a system otherwise dominated by thoroughly different dynamics. So he was always fascinated by how you have this sort of cultic liturgical politics in fascism, and yet being wedded to a bureaucratic rationality within the same people. So that's the era that has to be explored. And we're an era that it seems to me a religious university could be particularly empowered to explore. In a way that at the time, I don't think there was a very good discernment of spirits taking place either among the religious bodies or the secular intellectuals. And we know from both sides how disappointing their performance was in the around the time of the fascism and the Holocaust. This other dimension of the Holocaust here, 2B, the Righteous of the Nations project is probably something you know of, that in 1953, Israel decided to set up an institution to go around and try to recognize those people who had risked their lives or lost their lives trying to save Jewish life. And it could not have been done for financial gain. And so it's got some problems with its methodology, but it's a very ambitious project, and it's constituting a sort of archive of moral life at that time. And unless you have questions, I won't go into details about how they try to establish these people. But the reason I bring it up here is I've been teaching a course on the Holocaust for quite a few years, and about 3 or 4 years ago, I found myself near the end of the course. I think it was an inspired moment. I asked the class, how many Righteous of the Nations do they think there were at the time? And I had them jot it down. And I was startled to discover that people were guessing 5 people, 100. I don't think anyone guessed more than 500. And Yad Vashem actually has recognized 22,000 people. And Yad Vashem estimates that's 1/10 of the number of people who deserve recognition. So it's certainly changed the way I teach the Holocaust, but what was so clear to me, and I've had other indication of that, is the students did not appreciate the capacity of people to stand up to systems, to be heroic. And one of the other things about that, even though the vast majority of people who are recognized by this, by Yad Vashem are Christian, the studies that have been done of their statements as to why they rescued Jews, why they risked their lives, religion plays a very small part in explaining why they did what they did, which for me was surprising. I know some of those who have been recognized in the State of Israel, and two of them were Jesuits, so they had obvious religious motivation. But they're very exceptional. So it makes me wonder about, at a time when religious, you know, Christian formation was out there, and there was a Christian identity, what really was that about? If those who come out of that background and were heroic don't think that religion played much of a role in justifying what they did, in encouraging them to do. A third source for this approach is a Jesuit postmodern. Here I'm not going to go into this unless you ask me to. This is a book that came out. It wasn't a bestseller, so don't feel bad. It was an edited collection by Frank Clooney, who's now over at Harvard. And it was a group of Jesuits. We met regularly over the years talking about how it is the current perception of intellectual life among Jesuits differ from that was of the generation before and generations earlier, classic Jesuit. You know, we had the modern Jesuit, and the modern Jesuit is basically the ones who have empowered this sort of institution in terms of the way they thought about it. Appreciation for the autonomy of knowledge, disciplines, and so on. And then there is the postmodern Jesuits, which are not the counter-modern Jesuits. There are counter-modern Jesuits who call into question, you know, the Catholic university as it developed as too secular. Right? But the postmodern Jesuits were pointing out that maybe, you know, the stress of modern Jesuits on the autonomy of knowledge and the autonomy of disciplines perhaps was a bit naive too, that disciplines are part of a wider culture and they have interests themselves. That's the Foucault myth coming out. But there was also recognition that the modern Jesuit and the universities that came out of their cooperation did take knowledge very seriously. It wasn't subordinated to other projects, moral or religious. So, this memory came back to me this morning. I'm a New York Province Jesuit, which you can probably recognize by my accent. But
that's all right.
There are a lot of us around here. But one thing I recall from the seminary days is New York Province used to throw a dinner. I don't know how many years they did this, but they used to throw a dinner in recognition of those who wrote articles or books in the course of the year. They had a big dinner up in the philosophy. And they put out a very nice program with the identification of what had been written. And it left a strong impression on me as a young seminarian that, oh, this is a ministry, writing and researching and I was very impressed, and it's stayed with me. A fourth source is a remark that Hannah Arendt made that I've been puzzling with over the years, and it's that one citation right there. It's from her essay, What is Authority? But who can deny that faith, too, for so many centuries securely protected by religion, its beliefs and its dogmas, has been gravely endangered through what is actually only a crisis of institutional religion? And I found that very helpful for thinking out a difference between the crises that are afflicting institutional religion, some of which are, maybe most of which, are their own making, and this other dimension of faith life that, in her perception, was sheltered by much of the dogmas of religion, but maybe perhaps now is endangered by the those same orientations within religion. So the crisis of institutional religion, authority issues, identity, sexual identity issues, recruitment of clergy and such, all right, they're not the central issues of that worried Hannah Arendt in terms of human dignity, the community, all right, how we foster that confidence in the worth of human lives as opposed to the utilitarianism of our culture. Now, I found Dermot Murray extremely helpful in thinking about these issues. The Persons and Relation book is particularly good for me. It's one of his Gifford, it's a collection of Gifford lectures that he gave. The book is very complex, but there's an elegance in his framework. Namely that we are in community, we're born into community. And we can take up a positive relationship to that community of love and respect, or we can take up a negative relationship to community. And that comes out of fear. And he identifies these two fundamental attitudes, a sort of contemplative attitude where I don't want to be in real communion with the other, so I'm submissive. I get along, basically. That's my project in life, getting along with the other, not risking any sort of rupture. And then you have the pragmatic attitude, which is the realization that I can get these people to go along with what I want. So power becomes the issue, not submission. So in his philosophy, what he's trying to think out is how we can think of a positive relationship to one another. And he looks at various things, morality being one of them. And I Xeroxed a few pages from his book, Persons in Relation, which are part of this handout I gave you. So if you look on 124, in the second paragraph, about seven lines down, he's talking about morality and the different types, personal and impersonal morality. And this is helpful, I think, for thinking of religion, personal and impersonal modes of being religious. Right. The form will be of an organic type, a system of social habit. He's speaking of the submissive mode here, in which the activity of each member is functionally related to the activity of others, so that the practical life of the society is a balanced and harmonious unity, a system of social habit. To maintain this, each member must have his function in the common life. He must be trained from childhood to recognize the social pattern and his own function in it, and to develop the system of habits which makes conformity to it a second nature. The contemplative mode of morality is then a morality of good form. Wrong action is bad form, doing something that is not seemly, not fitting. Its standard is, in the broad sense, an aesthetic standard. It is not the sort of standard that can easily be formulated in general precepts. It has to be felt. It is a kind of beauty or grace in social relations. But it's an inferior form than what McMurray would call the communal form. On the next page, at the beginning of the next full paragraph, the other negative mode, negative because it's motivated by fear, which we have called pragmatic, is the antithesis and the complement of this aesthetic. If the material life, the life of action, is taken as real, then the life of the spirit is subordinate and becomes a means to practice. In that case, the conflict of wills is met by aggression, by the effort to overpower the resistance of other agents and compel them to submit. The second paragraph, the last paragraph on that page, this pragmatic mode of morality would then be conceived as obedience to law, to a moral law which the individual imposes upon himself and to which he secures the universal intention to maintain the community of action. It will be morality of self-control, of power over the self, limiting its own freedom. Now, I point that out because those are also modes in which we might think of religion in terms of the contemplative and the pragmatic. Now, on 164, he raised the question, how can a universal mutuality of intentional and active relationship be represented symbolically? Only through the idea of personal other who stands in the same mutual relation to every member of the community. Without the idea of such a universal and personal other, it is impossible to represent a unity of community of persons. Now, he says later, in its full development, the idea of a universal personal other is the idea of God. What he's interested in is we have the capacity to feel deeply about strangers who are suffering, say, in Congo right now. What is that relationship? Is it fantasy on our part that we construct that we're connected to them somehow, that we have a relationship? Or is there an ontological condition, a reality of a universal personal other with whom we are in relationship? And what moral action manifests is the reality of that ontological bond, which we don't have to recognize. We can perform the actions, but it doesn't reach the level, the depth level of recognizing that these actions are not just arbitrary whims. They really do confirm what reality is. Okay, in his way of taking it. And on the next page, he talks about the fear of the other as a fear of life. But that very last sentence, or the last two sentences on 165, religion then would be simply the celebration of community, of the fellowship of all things in God. Meanwhile, it sustains the intention to achieve this fellowship. Again, that's his notion of religion. But the relevance of that notion of religion for university, he makes quite explicit in that those final pages there. 176, 177. How am I doing on time? Not too bad.
Fine.
A minute over.
You're doing
great. Okay. On 176, and this has come up regularly in our seminar, the Catholic Fletcher tradition, you know, science on one hand as opposed to this aesthetic or philosophical. Right? How do we relate them? Can we relate them? Is this what the real story of the university is? Why we have a sense of fragmentation? Well, this is the way McMurray ties them together. And this to do greater justice, because he built up to this in the course of his book. Art and science are derived from religion by a limitation of attention. Their activities of reflection are carried on for their own sake, and not for the sake of the person or other. The one is an activity of emotional reflection, the other of intellectual reflection. As aspects of religion, they refer to action which integrates them, and they have therefore a reference to one another and qualify one another. This is possible because only so far as action is positively motivated and heterocentric. If they are carried on for their own sakes, the reference to the personal other is excluded from this intention of the activity, though it necessarily remains as a matter of fact that whatever we're doing in the university, it does take place within a personal context of some sort. As a result, they lose their intentional reference to one another and become antithetical. Religion, we might say, intends the synthesis of art and science. Art and science each intend themselves, and exclude one another. Art intends the germination of the possible, not of the actual. It's problematic in terms of satisfactory or unsatisfactory. But I'll skip that next section and go to that paragraph. We must not forget, however, that both art and science are, as a matter of fact, personal activities. They are the activities of persons and only of persons. It is the relation to the other that is impersonal. Artists and scientists alike are doing something, and the unity of the personal informs the doing. Again, we don't have disciplines. We have people practicing certain arts of knowing. There is then in all art an intellectual element, and all science an emotional element. And then finally, the last page I have there, 222, just that one paragraph, full paragraph at the end. There is then only one way in which we can think our relation to the world, and that is to think it as a personal relation through the form of the personal. We must think that the world is one action, and that its impersonal aspect is the negative aspect of this unity of action, contained in it, subordinate within it, and necessary to its constitution. To conceive the world thus is to conceive it as the act of God, the creator of the world, and ourselves as created agents, with a limited independent freedom to determine the future, which can be realized only on the condition that our intentions are in harmony with his intention, and which must frustrate itself if they are not. So that's his way of putting together the two major areas of the disciplines in terms of a living out of a personal faith, even if one does not articulate that in religious terms. One is living out a personal commitment in what he calls a personal community that does have an ontological foundation, right? Which is nothing new, but I find his way of formulating it very helpful. So,
great.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention.